Today on Central Standard, a professional illustrator and toy designer who's built an international brand around his name. His client base includes the National Football League, Bruce Lee's estate, and Kid Robot, to name a few. For him, it's a pretty mad world. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll also use a new novel to jump into our mental time machines and travel to 1980s Kansas City. Do you remember, for instance, what the plaza was like when it was mostly local shops and no nightlife? And pop quiz, what's the name of the German restaurant that used to be where Starbucks is now? And where did you used to eat before they made that spot Forever 21? And what was the name of the French bakery, now the site of a popular pizza place? We'll hear from an area writer who found the heat of KC's 1980 summer the perfect setting for his new novel. And the answers to those questions on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. It was a year when journalists vied to make sense of pivotal events in the Middle East and Europe. The economy was in recession, and there was a historic heat wave and a drought adversely affecting agriculture in the region, and in Kansas City, Royals baseball season was once again ended in disappointment. I'm not talking about last year, but rather 1980. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Hughes Keenan, a former Kansas City Star reporter and author of the new novel set mostly in the year 1980, a tale of George Brett's pursuit of a 400 batting average, a historic heat wave, geopolitical intrigue, and a metro area in transition. The book is called The Harvest is Past. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us about your book, The Harvest is Past.
Well, what do you want to know about it?
Well, first of all, where the title comes from?
The title comes from a biblical passage, Jeremiah 8:20, The Harvest is Past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved.
And how did you come about that passage? How did you come across it?
Probably about 30 years ago, and that's where the story originated was. I can't remember exactly where, but I was handed a religious handbill on the street, and that passage led on the front of the pamphlet, and it just – I thought to myself, I tucked it away, what kind of story would fit this?
Harvest has passed, summer has ended, and we are not saved. So how do you weave a yarn from that?
It takes many decades, I think. it just had to unfold over this time, and that's why it kind of directed me back to 1980. I think it was a very pivotal year, what was going on in American culture, the transition from the hope and possibilities of the 60s to kind of a hangover from the Vietnam War, and right before we got into the very conservative 80s and Reagan being elected to the office.
Give us a synopsis of your approach to this novel as if you were on the radio.
Well, I've never been on the radio, so I'm not quite sure how I would do a synopsis like that. Like we discussed earlier, I typically take a theme, and the theme for this one is loyalty. It's about three childhood friends and the experiences they have and how that results for some of them in some very, you know, physical and psychological damage. But they're still loyal to each other, and then kind of a group that gets together when the protagonist, Emmett Morley, comes back to town after his mother dies.
And tell us about Emmett Morley. Who is Emmett Morley?
Emmett Morley is I call him a shirt-tail Vietnam veteran. He was at the very end of the war during the evacuations of Phnom Penh and Saigon, and was involved in the Miguez, the botched rescue on Koh Tang Island. But he's a journalist. He ends up in Dublin working for an international wire service, and the book starts off in Belfast, and he's covering a bombing there, and then he learns that his mother's passed away, and he has to come back to bury her, and he's from Kansas City.
Are there any similarities between yourself and Morley? Are there parts that are autobiographical? It definitely seems so as the story progressed.
Other than the journalism background, no. Emmett's an only child. Both, you know, he's an orphan now. My parents are still alive, and I'm the oldest of six kids, and I certainly was never in the Marines.
In this book, the character, as you mentioned, Emmett Morley, transfers from Dublin to Kansas City. There's a personal reason and a professional reason. He's covering a bombing in Belfast. What are the challenges he faces as he comes back to the Kansas City of his youth?
Well, they're very personal. He's very detached. He has to face some of his old demons, not only psychologically but also physically in the antagonist, who's Rhodes Withorn. And he's pretty much avoided home. It's not a great memory to come back to. The three of them got into trouble. That's how he ended up in the Marines, and then he certainly gets damaged. But he comes back to because it's the opportunity, and it gives him the chance to rise in his profession as well, because as he's told by his bureau chief in Dublin, that if you do this, do it well, you can move up. We will have our eye on you. So he comes back and does what he needs to do to move up.
And what challenges are presented to Emmett Morley in the form of post-traumatic stress syndrome? You mentioned that. Shirt-tail Vietnam veteran, covering the bombings in Belfast, being involved in the Marines and reconciling all that as a journalist, returning home, everything seems to be sort of rounded.
I chose him as a journalist because it's the perfect profession with somebody with combat post-traumatic stress, because he can remain detached. He's very detached. He was detached from his family. Because of his upbringing, he's detached from his hometown. He's detached from his feelings. So being a journalist is the perfect cover for that for him, because he can still be involved and get the adrenaline of the excitement of covering the story and making the news break, and at the same time be able to stand back and say, I don't have to take a side. I can participate without being responsible in any way. So he can remain detached.
The story cuts a wide swath of subject matter, because it's important to note that Mr. Emmett Morley is a wire service reporter. So he's covering everything from sports to agriculture to politics, whatever's there. Talk about that.
He's responsible for a large geographic region, working for this large international wire service, which is a British-based firm.
Which you don't mention.
But I don't mention the name. Everyone else has mentioned.
Right.
he's responsible for essentially what his editors call the Great American Desert, or the Great American Outback, which is the Great Plains. And that involves everything that happens. Primarily, he's here to cover the financials on the Board of Trade, covering the grain markets, and then covering the agriculture that's involved with that. But he's also responsible for covering any general news, which would include sports, crime, just any type of breaking news. And then he also gets involved in this year, because it's a presidential election year. So he gets pulled in by the Washington desk as well, and he's torn in a lot of different directions. Clearly he wants to excel, and he works very hard at doing that, and develops a number of other feature stories that get a lot of attention overseas.
Is the Kansas City, the fictional Kansas City in your book, a Great American Desert, and is the actual Kansas City that you worked in a Great American Desert still, as of 1980?
Hardly Great American Desert, although the heat wave of 80 turned it into a desert, so to speak. But it's a this is a beautiful part of the country. I mean, it truly is. And one of the elements of the book is the 98, the Oldsmobile 980 drives, and how he can get around to different places, and how pretty it is, even though it's very open. Kansas City was
– and very American all the way down
very
to the
American
98 Oldsmobile.
Very, very American. It's an old lady car, but it's a wonderful ride on the highway, and that's how you get around this part of the country. And Kansas City was – it's changed a lot, but it remains the same. It was, and I think Edmund in it kind of refers to Kansas City as in 1980 as Paris in the 20s, or Vienna in the 1890s. Which is hard for some people to think of. But
talk about that. Kansas City of the 1980s is like Paris in the 20s,
Paris
or Vienna
in
the 1890s.
Kansas City
that's
was
pretty wide assessment.
Yeah, it's kind of something that's hard to grasp. But there was a real feeling that there was a real change in Kansas City that was going in 1980. The plaza, for example, hadn't become, it's chain-oriented for stores. I mean, there were a lot of more local things and restaurants down there. And there was just kind of more of an electricity in the air, even though, culture was starting to really come out a lot more. We've gone very far in Kansas City since then, certainly opening the Performing Arts Center this year. But there seemed to me more creativity in the city back then than there is now. It's almost become franchised, I think.
What was the difference in the Kansas City of 1980? You mentioned an electric atmosphere. What is the difference between then and now?
I think it was psychologically starting to break from its self-perception as a cow town, and was starting to branch out and reach out a little more, or at least you're right on the precipice of that starting to happen. It was the first time that we had a really good baseball team that, you know, we didn't see as a city, we didn't see great players being siphoned off to the Yankees. For the longest time, the Royals and before them, the A's were just basically farm clubs. And it was the first year that the Royals had a really great, probably one of the best baseball teams in the history of the franchise.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. Our guest is Hughes Keenan, former Kansas City Star reporter and Intrepid Wire Service reporter and author of the novel The Harvest is Past, a tale of George Brett's pursuit of a 400 batting average in the year 1980, a historic heat wave, geopolitical intrigue, and a metro area in flux and transition, mostly set in the year 1980. Kansas City, do you remember the 1980s in the metro area and the changes that took place in that decade? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's talk about pre-Pine Tar incident, George Brett. You were at the sports desk in 1980, a great decade for baseball, particularly that 1980 series pitting the Cy Young winner Steve Carlton against the American League's best hitter, arguably that year, George Brett. What was the environment like in Kansas City?
It was electric. I mean, it was nobody had come as close to that since Ted Williams.
Right.
And no one has come as close to that since George Brett. And particularly those days in August, up until he kind of fell apart by mid-September. Everybody was watching on a day-to-day basis. It was, you know, every single action Brett took off and on the field was watched, and it was, you know, you were rooting for him. Other than the pitchers that were facing him, everyone else was rooting for him. I think in Major League Baseball, it was a very exciting time. And particularly after such a scorching summer. But, you know, it wasn't just George. The whole team was very good that year.
But then something happened that became a pain in the you-know-what.
Sports writers learned how to spell the word hemorrhoids, yes.
And what about that? They learned how to spell it. Why?
Because it was in the World Series. It was after Game 2, I believe, before Game 3. Game 3, and there was a day – the series started off in Philly, the first two games, and then there was a lag day, I think, a travel day. And in Game 2, I believe it was, George came out in the sixth inning suffering from a pain in a very sensitive region. And then he had the surgery that during the off day, the travel day, and then came back to play in the third game.
Right, because that's what they did in the golden era.
Yes, you played baseball. It was a little lighthearted. You know, the Royals came back, but did end up losing the series in six games.
They did. They dropped it to the Phillies. The disappointment was palpable when Brett came in batting under 400, and the Philadelphia Phillies won that game in six games. That sentiment is somewhat echoed in your novel. Talk about the romance of heartbreak among KC sports fans and how it relates to the world that your book's protagonist, Emmett Morley, lived in.
Well, I mean, at the same time that the playoffs and the series are going, he suffers heartbreak as well with Hannah Freer, who he has this rather unrequited love and loyalty to. So it plays out at the same time that the city's heart's being broken. I think what happened in 80 with the baseball team is that after, sweeping the Yankees in three, and that's back in the days when a league series was 3 out of 5, the city was exhausted. Everybody was so celebrated out that by the time the series rolled around, there just wasn't the energy that there was. And by the time the series rolls around for Morley as well, he's in denial. He's in shock from what's happened to Henna. He stumbles through. And the city kind of stumbles through. I remember Roger Angel of The New Yorker wrote in his recap several months later after the 80 series about how the stadium at the first game in Kansas City just seemed to be lulled asleep by the fountains in the outfield. It just was a very quiet, subdued crowd versus the crowds that were there for the Yankees.
Back in the AstroTurf days,
yes,
as well.
Back in the AstroTurf days,
which
made
the,
that ball fly farther too,
and made
hot.
And made the heat all that much more palpable
much,
in the stadium.
Much
too.
More palpable too. Yeah. Fewer bugs though.
But this is also an era, Hugh, where we start to see the Rust Belt economy culture begin to take surface. Talk about that. How attitudes changed, and what the character Emmett Morley begins to notice in that year.
Well, that was, you know, it was the onset of what would soon be about 3 years of recession that was ushered in with the Reagan administration. It was also when a lot of Midwest manufacturing jobs had started to disappear. Factories, automotive plants, steel plants were starting, you know, locally were starting to be shut down, and there was a lot of job loss. I mean, and you know, inflation was very, very high at the time as well. So. The price of gas was going up, you know, past the 72 crisis. It was now starting to really inch up. And there, you know, there's a chapter in there where it's mentioned one of the characters complains that gas is at $1.34. In L.A., I think it's $4.30 a gallon. So it's all relative speaking. But it's kind of the beginning of a decay. I mean, you know, and which leads to, you know, this is a very Old Testament type of novel, and certainly pulled from the title, that, you know, the we are not saved.
It is a very Old Testament approach, with things happening in almost plague-like proportions, very, you know, pervasive throughout the life and throughout the world of Emmett Morley. Loss seems to be a recurring theme as well, with businesses that were there closing. You focus particularly on the Plaza in your book. Tell us about some of the places now closed and how that's changed the culture of the city.
Oh, you know, it's and I'm a huge Plazaphile.
Plazaphile,
yeah. Plaza's very unique. It's an amazing place. It's very unique. You'd be hard pressed to find anything like it in the world that's like it. But it's gone through a lot of changes. When I first came to Kansas City back in 71, 72, it was pretty much a retirement village. I mean, it was lots of you know, little old ladies lived down there with blue hair. And, you know, some of the changes are, and you've seen it in the headlines.
Now they're young ladies with blue hair that you could probably
Yeah, there weren't too many, yeah. It wasn't a place young people hung out by any means. But, for example, I refer to a Henna works at a department store called Herons, which is
right.
a playoff of Swanson's, which right. was owned by Hallmark Cards, which was the very high-end boutique clothing for women in Kansas City. It's now a Forever 21 and Cheesecake Factory.
Combined,
yes.
In that area.
And,
right.
And when Emmett first sees Henna, he's walking down the street from having lunch at what was Emile's, which is now a Starbucks.
Right.
So, you know, we've seen, you know, there's a reference to the French bakery, which was at the time Le Bon Boucher, which is now Cole Vines, I think. You know, so, you know, a lot of these places are, you know, while it's good for business, so to speak, it's not local. It's, you know, it's very chain. And even though the architecture, I think, of the Plaza has kept it unique, the stores themselves aren't necessarily unique.
Given the macro approach you take on many different subject matters and the world at large through the eyes of Kansas City, and then even smaller than that, through the eyes of your protagonist, Emmett Morley, why would you say that the area has become more homogenous? Chains.
Because you can find those stores anywhere. I mean, I think that's what I kind of liked of setting this in 80 in those particular places, is that there's a nostalgia.
Right.
You know, we've lost some things. I mean, you know, we've lost some of the uniqueness. Now, there's still pockets of it around. But, you know, you can go to almost any city of any, you know, C to B or A level city in the United States, and you're going to see these same stores pretty much in close proximity, whether it's a higher end strip mall or a shopping district. They're all going to be kind of the same stores selling the same product.
You live in Brookside. What's changed about that neighborhood?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Thankfully,
right.
Yes. Nothing. I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of part of the charm of Kansas City is that it changes, but it always remains the same. And I've always joked that as long as the Coca-Cola sign is off Southwest Trafficway, I'll always know Kansas City's here. It's still the same. Once that goes away, then I think all is lost.
What we see is a changing atmosphere and a changing ethos of news and news coverage in this story as well. What would the Morley character think of today's news environment?
He wouldn't be here for today's, but you have to read the book to find out. He would be discouraged, much as most journalists and former journalists are. It's a very tough environment, and there aren't as many practicing journalists as there used to be, which also has an impact, I think, on the advertising, marketing, and public relations field. That's typically – journalism was a feeder for those people – in that industry, and you're not getting that experience because you're having fewer people feed into it. There was a really good documentary done in 2010 called The Front Page Behind the New York Times, and it was, I think, devastating. It takes a very good look at modern American newspaper journalism in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, and you know, basically says that those are really the only two real newspapers left in the country that are doing that type of work that used to be done. And, you know, from a consumer perspective, it's devastating. From a journalist perspective, it's apocalyptic.
Talk about that contrast. You said now from a consumer perspective, not having that information at their disposal or not having the real hard news at their disposal or but for the people practicing it, it's apocalyptic.
I think from the consumer standpoint, their expectation is that it's been, you know, information, and we are in the information age these days. Has been vetted, that it, you know, that there is an unwritten contract that the information they're getting is true, or, you know, or is balanced and should be, and it's based on fact, and that's kind of broken down. I think. I mean, there are fewer people actually practicing that. I mean, you know, if you have an iPhone, you're a journalist.
automatically,
but without the training. And it takes that, you know, real critical eye, that very skeptical approach to doing a news story. And you have to be trained to do that.
Speaking of training and speaking of nostalgia, which are both throughout the book and journalism, all throughout the book, Emmett Morley's world is a world of potty mouth reporters and editors and drinks.
That was year two. I mean, you know, it was the drugs, the promiscuity was certainly more acceptable on a social basis than it is now. But if you're talking specifically of kind of that, you know, foul mouth newsroom environment where, you know, emotions were allowed to run free, but they weren't, you know.
They ball your copy up and throw it in the trash can in front of you?
Yeah. Literally had cups of hot coffee thrown at me or newspapers or an ashtray one time. And you know, you learn patience very quickly if you wanted to keep your job.
Is the lack of that wily environment part of the reason for lack of nerve among journalists?
I think it could be. I think in the modern – and this is my third novel after I finished the one I start now – is the modern American workplaces that we've – you know, while some of that behavior was outrageous, it you know, I think we've gone overboard in their workplace to coddle and to, you know, everybody's got to have strokes. Everybody's got to get a trophy and an award and everyone has to feel good at the end of the day. And I think there was a time, not that I'm, you know, nostalgic for it necessarily, where you got beat up in the workplace. You learned by doing things wrong and being called on the carpet for it.
And you don't feel that that's happening now?
I haven't seen it in the workplace in a long time. I think, you know, in controlled environments, which are, you know, corporate environments, there's, you know, don't say anything bad. You know, it's all, you know, let's look for the positive, and there's no such thing as a problem. It's always a challenge. And, well, that's, you know.
Or an issue.
That's BS. I mean, a problem's a problem. You need to deal with it. Let's quit putting different labels on it.
Now, if Emmett Morley were doing a news analysis piece on the Royals, what would he suggest they do to rise from perennial mediocrity to return to some of the great teams of the 80s, or at least get a franchise player, keep a franchise player?
Well, spend more money wisely. Although I'm, you know, big fan of Moneyball. I think that's, you know, for teams like this, that's the way to do it. Although I think this year, from what I'm gathering, this will be a team to watch. That's what my sources tell me. He, you know.
So would he write about run production, in other words?
I don't think Emmett would, no. I mean, it would be too close to covering the grain market, and he didn't particularly find that very tasteful. That's why he was busy out doing all the feature stories that he was trying to do, because he wanted to get out of covering that. It was numbers. It was arcane, and he wasn't a real numbers guy. He had to do the baseball. He got caught up in it because of the excitement. Had the team in 80 not been doing that well, Brett not hitting for 400, I doubt Morley would be that interested.
What's your next project about?
Next project is, like I said, I kind of focus. Harvest was about loyalty. The next book is about atonement, French Indochine cuisine, and a serial killer.
Wow. Atonement, French cuisine.
French Indochine cuisine.
French Indochine cuisine and the serial killer.
Right.
So you're revisiting that Vietnam vibe a little bit, too, with the French Indochine cuisine.
A little bit.
And serial killer.
Yeah, the working title of the novel is Saigon Laundry, but there's actually no relation to the Vietnam War whatsoever, other than he works out of this place that's called Saigon Laundry. He's kind of a fixer, a lawyer, PR guy who goes around fixing problems for people and then falls into this the serial killer.
Our guest is Hughes Keenan, former Kansas City Star reporter and author of a new novel called The Harvest Is Past. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Central Standard.